This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. My name is John Nichols. I want to announce, first of all, remind you all here tonight that Martine's reading this evening is the first of a series of events in Santa Fe over the next 3 months that are part of the Disappeared Collaborative Project, which will have many exhibitions, films, lectures, and workshops with artists whose lives have been affected by the political upheavals in Latin America over the last 40 years. I also mentioned that there'll be a book signing in the library after our presentation. This is the events calendar for the disappeared events that you can pick up in the library and the lobby also. I want to thank Martine Espada and the Lannan Foundation for inviting me to participate in this evening. It's an honor and an adventure for me to be here. My friend Martine was born in Brooklyn, New York in 1957, which is the same year that Hank Aaron won the National Baseball League's Most Valuable Player Award with Milwaukee. And in the World Series that year, Hank hit .393 with 3 home runs and 7 RBIs to help defeat the New York Yankees 4-3. This was Hank Aaron's way of celebrating Martine Espada's birth and his future destiny as a great poet and a great baseball fan. Speaking of the Yankees, Martine and I both root for the Boston Red Sox, and we hate the New York Yankees. In fact, Martine really endeared himself to me when I read his gentle and fierce poem entitled "Tato Hates the New York Yankees." Just for that, I bestow upon him the Nobel. Martine and I have many other things in common. For example, we both visited Cuba. Although I admit I was never actually in Cuba, I flew over it in a rickety Aeronica jet on my way to Sandinista, Nicaragua in 1983. I was 43 years old. Of course, Martine had already visited Nicaragua the previous year, 1982, when he was only 25. We shared similar experiences in that revolutionary country. Both of us were deeply moved when we both visited a small museum with photographs of young literacy volunteers on the wall. Many of those kids had been disappeared or killed by counter-revolutionaries funded by Ronald Reagan's administration, which wanted the Nicaraguan people to remain as illiterate as our own president. When he returned to the United States, Martine made radio documentaries about his time in Nicaragua for National Public Radio, and he wrote a number of enduring poems about the experience, some of which are in his marvelous selected poems in the award-winning book Alabanza. After Nicaragua, Martine also wrote a dazzling poem about his convoluted young life called "My 25th Year Amazed the Astrologers." Today, Martine is 50, but he's continued to amaze the astrologers during a colorful and inspiring career as a janitor for Sears, a bar bouncer, a primate lab caretaker, a civil tenant and immigration rights lawyer, a distinguished professor of literature, a noted poet, essayist, editor, and translator. He has authored 14 highly praised books, and is an organizer, a husband and father, and an eloquent spokesperson for his people of Puerto Rico and for the dispossessed on earth, who these days I feel include all of us who care about environment, human justice, and equality, and the mystery and power of literature to inspire joy and revolt. During his career, Martine has received many awards for his work, including the American Book Award for Imagine the Angels of Bread and the Patterson Award for Sustained Literary Achievement for Alabanza. He has also been a finalist for both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. His latest book, The Republic of Poetry, includes exquisite poems that speak of his connection to Victor Jara and Pablo Neruda and to their country, Chile, and its history. Some of you here may remember that Chile's great folk singer, Victor Jara, was killed during the U.S.-supported coup led by General Pinochet, which took place on this hemisphere's earlier, but just as tragic, September 11th in 1973. And Chile's Nobel poet, Pablo Neruda, died brokenhearted only 12 days after that coup. Martin and his work are the inheritance passed on from courageous artists and activists like Neruda and Victor Jara to the new generations who insist that hope cannot and will not be crushed. About his poetry, Martin has said in one of his essays in the collection Zapata's Disciples, "I am an advocate when I write poems speaking on behalf of those without an opportunity to be heard. For one of the curses of segregation and subordination by class is the imposition of silence." He adds, "What do we want, finally, when we write from an awareness of class and its punishments? We want change, which, as Frederick Douglass pointed out, does not come without demand. This is the poem as an act of political imagination." Inherent in all of Martin's work is that demand, even when you are laughing in delight or possibly dismay at his playful and stinging and provocative wit and his imagination, even when you are almost in tears by his startling tenderness. I believe it was Emma Goldman who once said, "If I can't dance, I don't want to be in the revolution." At myriad occasions and in myriad poems, Martin dances. Over the years, Martin and I have met in person on only a few occasions, yet I surely understand that our spiritual and political paths have crossed often. My friend, because of your beliefs, your tough and lyrical art, and your loving energy, it's a great pleasure for me to join the many others who have said, and I quote from one of your poems, "I savor the burst of air in the word compañero." Please welcome Martin Espada.
Muchas gracias. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank John Nichols, that beautiful introduction. And I'd like to thank the Lannan Foundation, everything they've done to make this event possible. I'm going to be reading from two of my books this evening, Alabanza and The Republic of Poetry, which is the new book. I'd like to begin with a poem about the island of Puerto Rico. This is a poem that grounds me. Of course, Puerto Rico, where my roots are, my family is from. And this is a poem about music. The first two poems are going to be about music, particularly the music brought by the slaves from Africa with their religion, which survived every attempt by the Spanish to stamp it out and is now an essential part of Puerto Rican culture, heritage, identity. If you go to Puerto Rico, if you go to Viejo San Juan, the old city, you'll find a street there called San Sebastián, which is famous for its music. There's a festival there every year, all year long. You can hear the music coming from the bars and the clubs on the street itself. Much of it, the music brought by the slaves from Africa. So for me, San Sebastián is a street of miracles, a street where the impossible can happen, even the end of war and the return of the dead. There's a very simple Spanish refrain in this poem, in La Calle San Sebastián, on St. Sebastian Street. So, start with this. En la calle San Sebastián, Viejo San Juan, Puerto Rico. Here in a bar on the street of the saint, in la calle San Sebastián, a dancer in white with a red, red scarf, in la calle San Sebastián, calls to the gods who were freed by slaves in la calle San Sebastián. And his bronze face is a lantern of sweat in la calle San Sebastián. And hands smack congas like flies in the field in la calle San Sebastián. And remember the beat of packing crates in la calle San Sebastián from the days when overseers banished the drum in la calle San Sebastián. And trumpets screech like parrots of gold in La Calle San Sebastián. Trumpets that herald the end of the war in La Calle San Sebastián. As soldiers toss rifles on cobblestone in La Calle San Sebastián. And the saint himself snaps an arrow in half in La Calle San Sebastián. Then lost grandfathers and fathers appear in La Calle San Sebastián. Fingers tugging my steel wool beard in La Calle San Sebastián. Whispering, "Your beard is gray," in La Calle San Sebastián. Spilling their rum across the table in La Calle San Sebastián. Till cousins lead them away to bed in La Calle San Sebastián. And the dancer in white with a face of bronze in La Calle San Sebastián shakes rain from his hair like the god of storms in La Calle San Sebastián, and sings for the blood that drums in the chest in La Calle San Sebastián, and praises the blood that beats in the hands in La Calle San Sebastián, in La Calle San Sebastián. Here's another poem about music and many other things besides. In June of 2000, I found myself in a place called Achill Island in Ireland, in the west, in County Mayo. I was there doing a writer's residency at a place called the Heinrich Bull Cottage. And there, I discovered a remarkable number of similarities between Ireland and Puerto Rico. It was amazing. Music and poetry, of course, but also history, colonialism. And there I was trying to figure out how to put it all together when I heard one night on the radio that Tito Puente had died. Tito Puente, a great Puerto Rican musician, had died. And I asked myself how I might memorialize this occasion. And so here it is. This is the first and I think the only Puerto Rican-Irish poem. And it's called "Now the Dead Will Dance the Mambo," Achill Island, Ireland, June 2000. Last night, the shadow of a cloud rolled off the bare mountain like a shawl slipping from the shoulder of a giant. Shirts on the clothesline sagged in rain. We burned turf, fists of earth blackening in the fireplace, room full of poets' books leaning rumpled, half asleep. All night a radio sang in Irish, tongues sod hard with lament or celebration. Then the BBC News and the announcer's lips pinching the name, Tito Puente, the Mambo King, dead in New York. I would listen to Tito's records and see my father years ago, black hair shiny as the spinning disc comb slick before the dance. I learned to spy on his mambo step, drum the pots and kitchen tables of Brooklyn. I saw Tito Puente, too, hammering timbales on the jazz boat in Boston Harbor, brandishing drumsticks overhead to scatter the malevolent spirits that grabbed at his hair. Guadalupe pushed backstage to return with Tito's drumstick splintered from repeating, always repeating, the beat of slaves. Here, on this island, I rehearse the Irish word for drum, borran, gripped by hand, like the pandereta, circle of skin and wood for the grandchildren of slaves to thump as they sang the news in Ponce, Puerto Rico. Again today, the rain grays the graying stones. We shake away drizzle in the pub, dwarfed by mountains. In brown Guinness light, we squint to see the posters of their Easter dead. James Connolly bellowing insurrection to the citizen army, the year 1916, a blaze above his head, numbers torched like the pillars of an empire's monuments to itself. The bartender says Connolly eyed the firing squad strapped to a chair in the stonebreaker's yard, gangrene feasting on his wound so he could not stand. I tell the bartender that Puerto Rico has its Easter dead. A march on Palm Sunday, colonial police intoxicated by the incense of gun smoke, cadets of the Republic painting slogans on the street in their belly blood. That was Ponce in 1937. And Rafael still says, my mother left in a white dress and came home in a red dress. Tito Puente is dead. And we are in a pub on Ockel Island plundering the jukebox, flipping between the wolf tones and the Dubliners till we discover Tito's Oye Como Va. The beat is a hand slapping the bar, heads nodding as if their ears funneled a chant of yes, 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 yes. And when we shoot a game of pool in his memory, the table becomes a dance floor at the Palladium, cue ball spinning through a crowd of red and green. Now, James Connolly could dance the mambo, gangrene forever banished from his leg. Well, I am originally from the tropical paradise of Brooklyn, New York. Yeah, Brooklyn in the house. I'm from the East New York section of Brooklyn, if you know the city. And after many years, I went back. This is a poem about going back. And it's called Return, 245 Wortman Avenue, East New York, Brooklyn. 40 years ago, I bled in this hallway. Half light dimmed the brick like the angel of public housing. That night, I called and listened at every door. In 1966, there was a war on television. Blood leaked on the floor like oil from the engine of me. Blood rushed through a crack in my scalp. Blood foamed in both hands. Blood ruined my shoes. The boy who fired the can off my head in the street pumped what blood he could into his fleeing leg. I banged on every door for help, spreading a plague of bloody fingerprints all the way home to apartment 14F. 40 years later, I stand in the hallway. The dim angel of public housing is too exhausted to welcome me. My hand presses against the door at apartment 14F like an octopus stuck to aquarium glass. Blood drums behind my ears. Listen to every door. There is a war on television. Strangely enough, that poem actually came out in the New Yorker in the style issue. You know, the style of the $1,000 Gucci handbags, right? All by themselves out on the tundra. As if to suggest if you are stranded on the tundra, this is all you will need to survive. And so in the middle of all this, in the style issue, there was my poem about getting hit in the head with a can and bleeding all over the place. It reminded me of this great simile by Raymond Chandler. He stood out like a tarantula on a wedding cake. Speaking of vermin, every Puerto Rican poet has to have a cockroach poem. It's true. I was informed, by the way, there are no cockroaches here. That's what I was told. But I know you have the concept of the cockroach. And every Puerto Rican poet has to have a cockroach poem. It's true. When I was a kid growing up in Brooklyn in the 60s, everybody thought we brought the cockroaches with us. Like we're getting on a plane in San Juan with these great big jars of live roaches, and shaking them out in the streets of New York, and go, my children, you're free. So I'm compiling cockroach poems. I'm going to put together an anthology called La Cucaracha. This is going to be my own contribution. My cockroach lover. The summer I slept on JC's couch, there were roaches between the bristles of my toothbrush. Roaches pouring from the speakers of the stereo. A light flipped on in the kitchen at night revealed a Republican National Convention of roaches. an Indianapolis 500 roaches. One night, I dreamed a giant roach leaned over me, brushing my face with kind antenna and whispering, "I love you." I awoke slapping myself and watched the darkness for hours because I realized this was a dream, and so that meant the cockroach did not really love me. That's it. Read that poem in Hollywood. I did a reading in Hollywood. And afterwards, a woman came up to me and said, "You know that cockroach poem?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "That's such a sad poem." I said, "Yeah, those human-insect relationships are so difficult, you know." Everybody stared at them in the street. Parents wouldn't approve, you know. Anyway. Well, I've had every job you could possibly imagine. I was a bouncer in a bar. My qualifications should be obvious. I worked in a primate lab taking care of baby monkeys. I'm the only poet you'll ever meet who's been bitten by a monkey. I wrote a poem called "Do Not Put Dead Monkeys in the Freezer," but I'm not going to read it because it's too disgusting. I'll read you this one instead. I used to work in a gas station. And this was back in the day, all right? So I worked in a place called Scott Gas. You know why it was called Scott Gas? Because Scots are supposed to be cheap. And the logo was the Scott, you know, winking at you. So this, of course, is a place where I learned about love. Learned about love in a gas station. So the poem is called "Rednecks," Gaithersburg, Maryland. At Scott Gas, Darnstown Road, the high school boys pumping gas would snicker at the rednecks. Every Saturday night, there was Earl, puckering his liquor-smashed face to announce that he was driving across the bridge, a bridge spanning only the whiskey river that bubbled in his stomach. Earl's car, one side crumpled like his nose, would circle slowly around the pumps, turn signal winking relentlessly. Another pickup truck, morning, and rednecks, loitering in our red uniforms, we watched as a pickup rumbled through. We expected, "Fill it with no lead, boy, and give me a cash ticket." We expected the farmer with sideburns and a pompadour. We, with new diplomas framed at home, never expected the woman. Her face was a purple rubber mask melting off her head, scars rippling down where the fire seared her freak face, leaving her a carnival where high school boys paid a quarter to look and look away. No one took the pump. The farmer saw us standing in our red uniforms, a regiment of illiterate conscripts. Still watching us, he leaned across the seat of the truck and kissed her. He kissed her all over her happy, ruined face, kissed her as I pumped the gas and scraped the windshield and measured the oil. He kept kissing her. And so my career continued. I got a job working in a printing plant. I used to make legal pads. And years later, I found myself in law school, surrounded by legal pads, and people who did not know how they got made. So I wrote this poem. Who burns for the perfection of paper? At 16, I worked after high school hours at a printing plant that manufactured legal pads. Yellow paper stacked 7 feet high and leaning as I slipped cardboard between the pages, then brushed red glue up and down the stack. No gloves, Fingertips required for the perfection of paper, smoothing the exact rectangle. Sluggish by 9 p.m., the hands would slide along suddenly sharp paper and gather slits thinner than the crevices of the skin, hidden. Then the glue would sting, hands oozing till both palms burned at the punch clock. 10 years later, in law school, I knew that every legal pad was glued with the sting of hidden cuts, that every open law book was a pair of hands upturned and burning. So I really did go to law school. I went to Northeastern University Law School in Boston. And for a number of years afterwards, I actually practiced law in the Latino community in Boston. I ended up writing a series of lawyer poems. Yeah, that sounds like an oxymoron, right? The poet lawyer, right? Like a creature out of Greek mythology. The body of a lawyer and the head of a poet, you know, running out of the woods. But I'm going to read you the shortest lawyer poem I have, which, believe me, is an act of kindness. This is a bilingual poem, and if you don't know Spanish, I know many people here do, but if you don't know Spanish, the only thing you need to understand this poem is to know that there is a mistranslation in the middle, which makes perfect sense since for Latinos, the legal system is mostly a series of mistranslations anyway. So here's the poem now, based on an actual exchange that took place in a district court in Boston. It's called Mariano Explains Yankee Colonialism to Judge Cullings. Judge, does the prisoner understand his rights? Interpreter, ¿entiende usted sus derechos? Prisoner, ¡pal carajo! Interpreter, yes. That's it. Yeah, but carajo does not mean yes. Yeah. You say that here? You use that phrase? Yeah. I'm not going to translate it. So. If you do hear it, or if for some reason it escapes your lips, just remember to have your hands free. Well, all the time I was practicing law, I was also practicing poetry. And one of my very first mentors was a poet that some of you know well. His name was Robert Creeley. And some of you also know that Robert Creeley died about 2.5 years ago, 2005. And I wrote this poem for him. At the time, I was actually guest editing a magazine called Plowshares. And I kept trying to get some poems from Bob. And Bob kept saying, I can't do it, I can't do it. And he even sent me an email at one point explaining why he couldn't write any poems, depressed about the war and all that. And then, right in the middle of the email, explaining why he couldn't send any poems, he wrote a poem. And it's one of the last poems he ever wrote. Yeah, I did publish it in Plowshares. And the refrain in my poem, which I'm about to read to you, actually comes from his poem. There's also a reference here to Marfa, Texas. Some of you may be familiar with Marfa. The poem itself is called You Got a Song, Man, for Robert Creeley, 1926-2005. You told me the son of Acton's town nurse would never cross the border into Concord, where the revolution left great houses standing on Main Street. Yet we crossed into Concord, walking through Sleepy Hollow Cemetery to greet Thoreau, his stone stamped with the word Henry, jutting like a gray thumbnail down the path from Emerson and his boulder of granite. We remembered Henry's night in jail, refusing tax for the Mexican War, and I could see you hunched with him, loaning Henry a cigarette, explaining the perpetual wink of your eye lost after the windshield burst in your boyhood face. When Emerson arrived to ask what you and Henry were doing in there, you would say, you got a song, man? Sing it. You got a bell, man? Ring it. You hurried off to Henry in his cell before the trees could bring their flowers back to Sleepy Hollow. You sent your last letter months ago about the poems you could not write, no words to sing when the president swears that God breathes the psalms of armies in his ear and flags twirl by the millions to fascinate us like dogs at the dinner table. You apologized for what you could not say, as if the words were missing teeth you searched for with your tongue, and then a poem flashed across the page, breaking news of music, interrupting news of war. You got a song, man, sing it. You got a bell, man, ring it. Today, you died 2,000 miles from Sleepy Hollow, somewhere near the border with Mexico, the territory Thoreau wandered only in jailhouse sleep. Your lungs folded their wings in a land of drought and barbed wire, boxcars swaying intoxicated at 4 a.m., and unexplained lights hovering in the desert. You said, there's a lot of places out there, friend. So you would go, smuggling a suitcase of words across every border carved by the heel of map makers or conquerors, because you had an all-night conversation with the world, hearing the beat of unsung poems in every voice, visiting the haunted rooms in every face. Drive, you said, because poets must bring the news to the next town. You got a song, man, sing it. You got a bell, man, ring it. Well, now, speaking of barbed wire, I want to read you a poem about the first time I had Thanksgiving dinner with my wife's family. My wife's family comes from a place called Rocky Hill, Connecticut. No rocks, no hill. It's a dairy farm country, or it used to be. Now, these are the suburbs of Hartford. And here's something you may not know about Hartford. Hartford is now the Puerto Rican city. Percentage-wise, there are more Puerto Ricans in Hartford, Connecticut, than in New York. We shall overrun. Well, that's the way it looks to the people who live in the suburbs of Hartford, because they watch television and see the image of the Puerto Rican criminal coming through the window, steal the DVD player. A few years ago, we came for the VCR, now we're back. Good update to technology. Anyway, the Puerto Rican is definitely the boogeyman in the suburbs of Hartford, Connecticut. So imagine the delight of my wife's family when my wife brought the boogeyman home for Thanksgiving dinner. Now, you've all heard of this thing called poetic license. That's the poet's right to make stuff up in the service of truth. I didn't need it. Everything happened just this way, and I need to say that in advance, or you will not believe me. So here's the poem now, holiday poem. Think of this when you're carving your turkey. Next month, it's called Thanksgiving. This was the first Thanksgiving with my wife's family, sitting at the stained pine table in the dining room. The wood stove coughed during her mother's prayer, amen, and the gravy boat bobbing over fresh linen. Her father stared into the mashed potatoes and saw a white battleship floating in the gravy. Still staring at the mashed potatoes, he began a soliloquy about the new Navy missiles fired across miles of ocean, how they could jump into the smokestack of a battleship. Now, Korea, he said, I was a gunner, and the people there ate kimchi, and it really stinks. Mother complained that no one was eating the creamed onions. Eat, Daddy. The creamed onions look like eyeballs, I thought, and then said, I wish I had missiles like that. Daddy laughed at 1950s horror movie mad scientist laugh and told me he didn't have a missile, but he had his own cannon. Daddy, eat the candied yams, mother hissed, as if you were a liquored CIA spy telling secrets about military hardware to some Puerto Rican janitor he met in a bar. I'm a toolmaker. I made the cannon myself, he announced, and left the table.
Daddy's family has been here in the Connecticut Valley since 1680, Mother said. There were Indians here once, but they left.
When I started dating her daughter, Mother called me a half-black, but now she spooned candied yams on my plate. I nibbled at the candied yams. I remembered my own Thanksgivings in the Bronx, Turkey, with arroz y habichuelas, some plátanos, and countless cousins swaying to Boogaloo on the record player or roaring in my grandmother's Spanish punchlines in the kitchen, the glowing of her cigarette, like a firefly lost in the city. For years, I thought everyone ate rice and beans with turkey at Thanksgiving. Daddy returned to the table with a cannon, steering the black steel barrel. does that cannon go boom? I asked. I fire it in the backyard at the tombstones, he said. That cemetery bought up all our farmland during the Depression. Now we only have the house.
He stared and said nothing, then glanced up suddenly like a ghost that tickled his ear.
Want to see me fire it?
He grinned. Daddy, fire the cannon after dessert, Mother said.
If I fire the cannon, I have to take out the cannonballs first, he told me.
He tilted the cannon downward, and cannonballs dropped from the barrel, thudding on the floor and rolling across the brown braided rug. Grandmother praised the turkey's thighs, said she would bring leftovers home to feed her Congo gray parrot. I walked with Daddy to the backyard, past the bullet holes in the door and his pickup truck with the Confederate license plate. He swiveled the cannon around to face the tombstones on the other side of the backyard fence.
This way, if it hit anybody, they're already dead, he declared.
He stuffed half a charge of gunpowder into the cannon and lit the fuse. From the dining room, Mother yelled, Daddy, no!
Then the battlefield rumbled under my feet. My head thundered. Smoke drifted over the tombstones. Daddy laughed, and I thought, when the first drunken pilgrim dragged out the cannon at the first Thanksgiving, that's when the Indians left.
Now, a lot of people have expressed concern for my health since the publication of this poem. They point out that my father-in-law is heavily armed. And they ask me the same question over and over again and say, have they read the poem? And I said, read the poem? I handed them the book. And I discovered something very important. It's a lesson I will share this evening. The safest place in the world to hide a poem is between the covers of a book.
So write whatever you want.
Well, you can see, though, why I might want to leave the country temporarily. And so I did. And I went to a place called Chile. And John mentioned this in his introduction. I was there in Chile in July 2004 to take part in the commemoration of the Pablo Neruda centenary. 100 years since the birth of Pablo Neruda. And this turned out, of course, to be a celebration not only of Neruda, but of poetry and of democracy, as democracy has slowly come back to Chile after the Pinochet dictatorship, all 17 years worth. I began to think of Chile as the Republic of Poetry, and I wrote this poem. It's going to strike some of you as magical realism. I assure you that everything in the poem actually happened. The Republic of Poetry for Chile. In the Republic of Poetry, A train full of poets roll south in the rain as plum trees rock and horses kick the air and village bands parade down the aisle with trumpets, with bowler hats, followed by the President of the Republic shaking every hand. In the Republic of Poetry, monks print verses about the night on boxes of monastery chocolate. Kitchens and restaurants use odes for recipes from eel to artichoke, and poets eat for free. In the Republic of Poetry, poets read to the baboons at the zoo, and all the primates, poets and baboons alike, scream for joy. In the Republic of Poetry, poets rent a helicopter to bombard the National Palace with poems on bookmarks, and everyone in the courtyard rushes to grab a poem fluttering from the sky, blinded by weeping. In the Republic of Poetry, the guard at the airport will not allow you to leave the country until you declaim a poem for her, and she says, "Ah, beautiful." I visited the house of Neruda at Isla Negra, which is a stunning place. If you have a chance to go, please do. And found myself up in Neruda's bedroom, a big picture window looking out over the sea. And it was there that I recalled a story, something I had heard various times, something that happened right after the coup, the first 9/11, September the 11th, 1973. This is a poem called "The Soldiers in the Garden." Isla Negra, Chile, September 1973. After the coup, the soldiers appeared in Neruda's garden one night, raising lanterns to interrogate the trees, cursing at the rocks that tripped them. From the bedroom window, they could have been the conquistadores of drowned galleons back from the sea to finish plundering the coast. The poet was dying. Cancer flashed through his body and left him rolling in the bed to kill the flames. Still, when the lieutenant stormed upstairs, Neruda faced him and said, "There is only one danger for you here, poetry." The lieutenant brought his helmet to his chest, apologized to Señor Neruda, and squeezed himself back down the stairs. The lanterns dissolved one by one from the trees. For 30 years, we have been searching for another incantation to make the soldiers vanish from the garden. John also mentioned in his introduction the great singer, songwriter, guitarist Victor Jara. Victor Jara was one of the victims of the coup, rounded up and murdered in the days following the military takeover. When I visited Chile, I also had the opportunity to meet Joan Jara, Victor's widow, and together we went to the place, the stadium, where he was killed. It is now named for him. And there are many ways we could talk about the coup. We could talk about thousands of people killed and tens of thousands of people imprisoned and tortured, but I think it's important to focus on the individual human story, a love story, in fact. And that's what this is all about. This is a four-part poem, and it's called "Something Escapes the Bonfire" for Victor and Joan Jara. One, "Because We Will Never Die," June 1969. Victor sang his peasant's prayer, "Levántate y mírate las manos." Stand up and look at your hands, gloved in hard skin, the hands of Victor's father petrified into fists steering the plow. Estadio Chile cheered, delirious as a man who knows he has plowed his last field for someone else, who hears a song telling him what he knows with the back of his neck. Joan, the dancer who twirled before crowds at the same shanty towns where Victor sang, leaned forward in her seat to hear it, first prize at the new song festival for Victor Jara. These are the nights we do not sleep because we will never die. How then could he squint into the dark somewhere beyond the back row, raise his guitar and sing? We'll go together, united by blood, now and in the hour of our death. Amen. 2. The Man with All the Guns, September 1973. The coup came, and soldiers whipped the enemies of the state, hands on head and single file, through the stadium gates. Condemned faces bled their light in the halls of Estadio Chile. The light floats there still. The killers had their light, too, spectral cigarettes glimmering in every corridor, especially the prince, or so the prisoners called the blonde officer who smiled at his work as if churches sang in his head. When Victor slipped into the hallway, away from thousands gripping knees to chest as they awaited the cigarette in the neck or stared back at the staring machine guns, he met the prince, who must have heard singing in his head, since he recognized the singer's face, strummed the air, and slashed a finger across his throat. The prince smiled like a man with all the guns. Later, when the other prisoners realized there were no wings on their shoulders to fly them from the firing squad, Victor sang, "Venceremos!" We will win. And the band anthem lifted shoulders as the prince's face reddened in a scream. If his own scream could not quiet the song pulsing through the veins in his head, reasoned the prince, then the machine guns would. 3. If Only Victor, July 2004. Crack the face of every clock at Estadio Chile. In this place, 31 years are measured by Victor's last breath, a moment, as in momento, the last word of the last canto he wrote before the bullets swarmed into the honeycomb of his lungs. Her eyes still burn. Her tongue still freezes. Again for Joan, the helicopters roar, military music drums across the dial, soldiers rifle butt women in the breadline. Again she finds her husband's body in the morgue, amid the corpses piled like laundry, and lifts his dangling, fractured hands in hers as if to begin a waltz. Yes, now they have named the stadium where he was killed for him. Yes, his words flow in stone across the wall of the lobby. Yes, there are Chinese acrobats tumbling here tonight. Yet she would rip away the sign flourishing his name, hammer down the wall of his words, and scatter the acrobats into the streets if only Victor would walk into the room to finish their argument about why he moved so slowly in the morning that he almost always made her late for class. 4. Something Escapes the Bonfire, July 2004. South of Santiago, far from Estadio Victor Jara, under a tent where the spikes of rain rattle off the canvas, a boy and girl, born years after the coup, lean across a chair on stage to fill their eyes with each other's faces. The tape rumbles, and Victor's voice spirals, delicate as burnt paper, to the ceiling, singing of a lover's silence to the dancers who uncurl the tendrils of their bodies. Something escapes the bonfire where the generals warm their hands, embers from burnt paper, buried tapes, voices teeming in the silence like the invisible creatures in a glass of water. How a dancer spins to the music in her head, alone, but for the tingle of fingertips at her elbow. Thank you. I'm going to finish my reading with this poem. This is also a 9/11 poem, our 9/11. But the focus here is on the immigrant food service workers who were killed that day. The word alabanza means praise in Spanish. And the full title of this poem is Alabanza in Praise of Local 100, for the 43 members of hotel employees and restaurant employees, Local 100, working at the Windows on the World restaurant who lost their lives in the attack on the World Trade Center. Alabanza. Praise the cook with a shaven head and a tattoo on his shoulder that said, Oye. A blue-eyed Puerto Rican with people from Fajardo, the harbor of pirates centuries ago. Praise the lighthouse in Fajardo, candle glimmering white to worship the dark saint of the sea. Alabanza. Praise the cook's yellow pirate's cap worn in the name of Roberto Clemente, his plane that flamed into the ocean loaded with cans for Nicaragua, for all the mouths chewing the ash of earthquakes. Alabanza. Praise the kitchen radio dial clicked even before the dial on the oven so that music and Spanish rose before bread. Praise the bread. Alabanza. Praise Manhattan from 107 flights up, like Atlantis glimpsed through the windows of an ancient aquarium. Praise the great windows where immigrants from the kitchen could squint and almost see their world. Hear the chant of nations. Ecuador, Mexico, República Dominicana, Haiti, Yemen, Ghana, Bangladesh, Alabanza. Praise the kitchen in the morning where the gas burned blue on every stove and exhaust fans fired their diminutive propellers. Hands cracked eggs with quick thumbs or sliced open cartons to build an altar of cans. Alabanza. Praise the busboy's music, the chime-chime of his dishes and silverware in the tub. Alabanza. Praise the dish dog. The dishwasher who worked that morning because another dishwasher could not stop coughing, or because he needed overtime to pile the sacks of rice and beans for a family floating away on some Caribbean island plagued by frogs. Alabanza. Praise the waitress who heard the radio in the kitchen and sang to herself about a man gone. Alabanza. After the thunder, wilder than thunder, after the shutter deep in the glass of the great windows, after the radio stopped singing like a tree full of terrified frogs, after night burst the dam of day and flooded the kitchen, for a time the stoves glowed in darkness like the lighthouse in Fajardo, like a cook's soul. Soul, I say. Even if the dead cannot tell us about the bristles of God's beard, because God has no face. Soul, I say, to name the smoke beings flung in constellations across the night sky of this city and cities to come. Alabanza, I say, even if God has no face. Alabanza. When the war began, from Manhattan and Kabul, two constellations of smoke rose and drifted to each other, mingling in icy air. And one said, with an Afghan tongue, "Teach me to dance. We have no music here." And the other said, with a Spanish tongue, "I will teach you. Music is all we have." Thank you very much. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
That was wonderful. This is the first time I've been on a stage in about 20 years, and so I brought along a lot of support, like my blankie, various books, Joan Jara, about Victor, an unfinished song. I wanted to put a few books here like little talismans while we talk. The clock hasn't started yet, thank goodness. I have these little tiny books. That one is called Autopsy on Surrealism by Cesar Vallejo, the great Peruvian radical poet. One is called Poetry and Militancy in Latin America by Roque Dalton, another great El Salvador poet. This is La República de la Poesía by Martín Espada that was published in Chile. This is called The Revolution is to Be Human by Walter Lowenfels. Walter Lowenfels said that one of these pages here, that an artist might be described as someone who tells the truth without being executed first. What else do I have? I also have a little cup that says Neruda Chile that a friend of mine from Santa Fe gave me when she came back from Chile. Put the little cup here. And this is a little Zapatista doll that was given to me by someone from Chiapas. And it fits in the cup. The little feet go right in. And it can observe this evening. Now, I wanted to start out in a really lighthearted... Oh, I forgot one thing. This is a postcard of Pablo Neruda's bedroom in Isla Negra that Martin was just talking about. What is a pen and teller, right? I'm pen, you're teller.
I don't have to say a word.
Yeah. The where I come from, speaking of being a lawyer, people say, buen abogado, mal vecino. It's your good lawyer, but your bad neighbor. This question that I want to begin with, Martin, is it has two parts. One, John Berger has written in his book Art and Revolution, the present condition of the world, if accepted as it is, if approached with anything short of determined impatience to change it utterly, renders every value meaningless. We have reached the stage of acquiring faculties which demand a world of equality. Either that demand is met or we deny our faculties and render our very being void. Now, sometimes I get really tired of being so heavy all the time. I get tired of hearing myself pontificate about global warming, ozone holes, genocide in Darfur, U.S. atrocities in Iraq, torture in Guantanamo, extinction of species, starvation in Haiti, the meltdown of Britney Spears, the unequal distribution of wealth on Earth, and so forth. I mean, I get up in front of people like tonight, and I just want to start babbling about the insanity of humanity while I'm projectile vomiting into the audience and shrieking, up against the wall, honky MFers or Black Power's going to get your mama. It's really, really hard for me to remain civilized anymore. Martin, how do you manage, day after day in the face of the deluge, to stand up in front of people, in front of students, in front of your own wife and son, while remaining chipper as a little old chipmunk, and with that cheerful bluebird of happiness just singing on your shoulder?
Well, I am famously cheerful. I am known to smile annually. I think the question really goes to the whole issue of hope. And how can you have hope in hopeless times? And there are many ways to address that. I like to take a historical perspective on it. And when I need a historical perspective, I talked to a friend of mine. His name is Abe Osheroff. Abe is 92 years old. He has been an activist since 1930, and he is one of the very few surviving members of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade that went, volunteered, in fact, to fight against fascism in the Spanish Civil War. And Abe, who is not sentimental in the least, is also capable of providing context, a perspective, on what appears to be
our state of hopelessness. In Brooklyn, New York, Abe used to get up on a soapbox. This is in the 1930s. And he would talk about these crazy things like unemployment compensation and workers' compensation. And his friends, fearing for him, embarrassed for him, would pull him aside and say, "A.B., they're going to pay us not to work?" Well, here we are. It's 2007. And these crazy ideas that got Abe Osheroff pulled off a soapbox are taken for granted by everybody across the political spectrum. And I really do believe that this is the nature of change. Nothing changes, nothing changes, nothing changes, nothing changes, and then everything changes. And all we have to do to confirm this hypothesis is talk to the people who've been there. How's that?
What is the change we're talking about? What do we want?
What do we want? Well, I think, as far as I'm concerned, first what we want is to stop being a warrior society. Pablo Neruda wrote a poem called Que Despierta el Leñador. I wish the woodcutter would wake up, or the rail splitter, in reference to Lincoln. It was a poem about the United States. It's something that he published in the late 1940s. And there's a passage in the poem where he speaks directly to this whole issue. He speaks to North America and he says, "What we love is your peace, not your mask. Your warrior's face is not handsome." And indeed, you can look at the way the world responds to us to see that Neruda was right. On the one hand, the world continues to be appalled by our warrior mentality. On the other hand, there are certain aspects of our culture that are readily and enthusiastically embraced by the world. Baseball, in many ways, is more powerful than our war machine. Music, in many ways, is more powerful than our war machine. And this is what we want the rest of the world to take away from contact with us. Not perpetual war, which not only is responsible for thousands upon thousands of deaths and countless other examples of misery around the world, but which is draining valuable resources from this country, away from education, away from healthcare, away from jobs, away from human dignity, because ultimately that is what we are addressing. I mean, we want to be a society that embraces human dignity instead of pushing humanity face down into the mud.
When to what extent, I noticed in the flyers for the 3 months of events that are going to take place around the disappeared.
Yes.
That most of the artists, I think, are Latin American artists that are going to be in Santa Fe. Most of the films, I think, were made in Latin America. It's the disappeared is kind of considered a problem in Latin America. I would say here as an aside, I didn't see any mention of the movie The Official Story in the films that are going to be shown, so everybody should go out and rent The Official Story, which is an Argentine film about the disappeared. But I think about this, and I wonder, the question kind of is, I was in Guatemala in 1964. I arrived in Guatemala after a bus trip from New York City to Guatemala City. The day after a state of siege had been lifted in Guatemala, I really got my head turned around because everybody hated Americans and everybody told me about the 1954 CIA-inspired coup that overthrew the Arevalo Arbenz government and put in Castillo Armas as the first of bloody dictators for decades and decades. You and I were both in Nicaragua during the Sandinista Revolution, I there in 83, you in 82. And they had overthrown the Somoza dictatorship, which for decades was sponsored by the United States. I remember reading a quote by President Roosevelt saying that Somoza was a real bastard, but he was our bastard, right? Yeah. I think of the United States, the CIA helping to engineer a coup that overthrew Mossadegh in Iran, leading to the Shah, and the terrible repressions that happened there that finally led to the Islamic Revolution with Ayatollah Khomeini, etc. You can think of invasions of Haiti, Puerto Rico, the Caribbean, you know, by U.S. Marines going in. We supported people like Papa Doc Duvalier. We supported Batista. We supported Trujillo in the Dominican Republic, etc. To what extent, in this short, concise, crisp little question, do you think that the United States is responsible for a great deal of the world's disappeared?
Well, certainly, if you look at the case of Latin America, the United States bears a great measure of responsibility for the desaparecidos, bought and paid for with our tax dollars. That is no doubt true. Something else I think we need to keep in mind, though, when we're considering this history and considering our present, is that we can now look to the countries where democracy has returned in Latin America, the countries that wrestled and continue to wrestle with the problem of the desaparecidos, and accountability for those who made all those human beings disappear. We can look to those countries as an example of what ought not to happen in this country. And if that sounds far-fetched, consider this. In Chile, there was, among certain elements of the middle class and upper class, prior to the coup and even after the coup, the prevailing notion that security had to be won at any cost. Security had to be won at any cost, even if it meant sacrificing civil liberties. And now we see in this country the erosion of our civil liberties in the name of security. It doesn't work. It's not effective, and it's the wrong trade-off in the first place. You know, we have now introduced concepts of torture and extraordinary rendition into our legal vocabulary. This is the first step to sanitizing and legitimizing some of the most barbarous of all human practices. And we have to put a stop to it any way we can. We're getting heavy.
Right? Hey, I like being heavy. Nobody hears enough heavy. It's like, I want to... this is a book called Latin American Revolutionary Poetry, which is edited by Roberto Marquez. I know that's a book that touched you at a certain point in your life. I would like you to read one poem in here. It's one of my favorite poems by Roque Dalton.
Okay.
If you wouldn't mind doing it. No. And this poem, I think, tells the history of the United States and Latin America in the last 150 years or whatever, beautifully. It's called OAS.
Oh, yes. OAS. The president of my country is, for the moment, called Colonel Fidel Sanchez Hernandez. But General Somoza, the president of Nicaragua, is also the president of my country. And General Stroessner, the president of Paraguay, is also a little the president of my country, although less than the president of Honduras, or rather General Lopez Arellano, and more than the president of Haiti, Monsieur Duvalier. And the president of the United States is more the president of my country than the president of my country, the one who, as I said, is for the moment called Colonel Fidel Sanchez Hernandez.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to get lighthearted here, huh? Question number 13. What is going to happen when Fidel Castro dies? Or do you think Castro is immortal? Or Will the United States suddenly be sucked up into the Van Allen radiation belt while Castro laughs at us?
That last thing you said.
The last thing I said.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
That's a very quick answer to that question. You've had a career, as you mentioned, as a janitor, both in Sears and a baseball park. You've been a bindery plant worker, a gas station attendant, an encyclopedia salesman, a pizza cook, a phone solicitor, a bar bouncer, a primate lab caretaker, a night desk clerk, a radio journalist, a mental patient advocate, a welfare rights paralegal, a law student, an attorney for the poor, a professor, a poet, an editor and translator. And you once asked yourself in print, what next? Chimney sweep? Rodeo clown? My question is, have you ever dreamed about opening a tiny shop in San Juan, Puerto Rico that sells comic books by Reuse and other political cartoonists of his ilk? Or if not that, what?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I'm not being facetious at all. I have a dream of a retreat. And instead of going up on the mountaintop, where it would be difficult to get cable, I have this dream of owning a little bookstore. And, you know, nobody comes in. And I worked in a bookstore like this. You left this out. I worked in a bookstore while I was in law school. It was a place called Fiction Literature of the Arts in Brookline, Massachusetts. It was owned by a poet named Sam Cornish, who was a wonderful guy, and his wife, Lorella Orowan. And this was a real, used to call it a white elephant. You remember, there's nothing going on there. And so they paid me minimum wage, which I think in those days must have been $4 an hour. And I was there for 8 hours. They give me $32, which was about $25 more than I took in at the till during the day. That, to me, would be the ideal job. I sat around and read books all day. You know, and there is something very attractive about peace of mind. So I've heard.
Do you think you'll ever go there?
I hope so. I don't know.
Do you have any plan for the rest of your life, for the future of your life?
I'm actually blessed in that I never consider consequences. Some people confuse this with courage. It's not courage. Uh-huh. I just don't think about what's going to happen next, you know. And so I am free of the whole concept of planning my life. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember when I was 50. I was 50 in 1990.
Yeah.
And at 67, it's extraordinary how life has changed.
Yeah, I actually like being 50. I mean, you know, every few months another piece breaks off, but, you know.
When I was...
Just put it in your pocket and move on, basically.
When I was 50, I remember I was getting divorced in one marriage. I was headed towards another marriage. I was struggling so hard to publish books, and I was working on movies. Have you ever worked on movies?
Actually, I have been featured in a number of films where I am cut out at the last possible moment. Future generations will know what I sounded like, but not what I look like. I have been cut out of not one, but actually two documentaries about Mumia Abu-Jamal, which must be some kind of record. I think there's a kind of vampire effect going on where when they point the camera at me, everything gets blurry. And then they look at it later and say, well, it's a shame, you know, but we have to take it out. I have absolutely no luck at all with the medium of film.
I got into it by accident when was this, 1979 or 1980? I got a phone call asking me if I would like to work on a film with Costa Gavras. I don't know if people here know Costa Gavras. He's a Greek filmmaker who fled to France in the time of the colonels and became famous in France for doing a film called Z about the Greek military coup. And then he made a film called State of Siege, which was basically about the kidnapping of an American, I guess, CIA agent or counterinsurgency agent in Uruguay, who was kidnapped by Tupamaros guerrillas and killed, ultimately, because this Dan Mitrione was in Uruguay teaching, basically, dictators how to keep their population under wraps. The movie that I was invited to work on was called Missing, which brings us back to Chile, Pablo Neruda and Victor Jara. Missing is the story. It was a film that was finally made and released in 1981 that featured Jack Lemmon and Sissy Spacek. And it was about the murder of two young Americans in Chile during the Pinochet coup. One was named Charles Horman and one was named Frank Turugi. Curiously, I had corresponded with Frank Turugi because he and Charlie Horman were putting out little press packets supporting Salvador Allende and Unidad Popular, his government. And I was sending the money for these packets. And the last packet they sent out had a cartoon of mine in it that had appeared in Liberation News Service news packet. And I was watching TV one day when Walter Cronkite said, today it was revealed that the body of an American named Frank Turugi had turned up in the morgue in Chile. And very much like you talk about the discovery of Victor Jara's body. And 6 years later, I wound up working on a picture about that. I just completely forgot what I was driving at here. It's like, this happens to me a lot. I get off on a tangent.
I'll take it.
Take it, Martin. Thank God.
First of all, if you haven't seen Missing, rent it. If you haven't seen it in a long time, rent it. It is one of the best films ever made about Latin America, and that is John's screenplay. You really must see it. And I will also say this. When I met with Joan Jara and we went to the stadium, one of the things we talked about was the movie Missing. And she told me that for the international solidarity movement around Chile, everything could be divided into before Missing and after Missing, which demonstrates the enormous power of popular culture in this country and in our culture in general. We have a tremendous impact on the world, and I think we underestimate that sometimes. And so we have a responsibility not only to do the right thing, but simply to know more about the world, which is why I just got back from Norway.
Norway? What were you doing in Norway?
I was reading to the Norwegians.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Didn't you want me to read a baseball poem?
One of my questions. Question 11. Yes.
Question 11.
What is question 11? I do want you to read that baseball poem.
All right, because the clock says we're almost done.
We're almost done, yeah. Wait a minute. What is the name of that poem? It's a complex poem about the Toledo Mud Hens with a date. It's one of the most wonderful baseball poems, evocative poems that I've heard. Yes, please read that. Then we'll wrap it up.
I don't have it.
Oh, I will have it. Just a sec. Which book is it in?
It's a sinking feeling.
Excuse me?
Yeah, it's in Imagine the Angels of Bread.
Oh.
Yeah.
There we go.
It's an awful
Thank
feeling.
Thank God I brought this
in front of all of you to admit that. But it's in this book.
I never get flustered on stage.
No. Right. Okay. There was some advantage to you bringing your picnic basket.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so I think we'd like to finish our conversation with this poem. And it's a documentary poem. There I was. It was the first game I ever attended with my son. And I was working somewhere in Ohio where the big fun was finding one of the roads leading out. And indeed, we found the road to Toledo. A mud hen, incidentally, is not a chicken. It's a coot. So, here's the poem, and it's a baseball poem. Red Sox, by the way, were winning 4-0 in the fifth inning when last I checked.
Yes, me yes. too.
This poem is called Rain Delay. Toledo Mud Hens, July 8th, 1994. Despite the rumors of rain, the crowd spreads across the grandstand. A hand-sewn quilt, red and yellow shirts, blue caps. The ball game is the county fair in a season of drought, the carnival in a town of boarded factories, so they sing the anthem as if ready for the next foreign war. Billboards in the outfield sell lumber, crayons, newspapers, oldies radio, three kinds of beer. The ball players waiting for the pitch. The catcher coiled beneath the umpire's alert leaning. The infielders stalking with poised hands. Then the pitcher, a weather vane spinning in wind. Clear echo of the wood, a ground ball throw, applause. The first baseman shouts advice in Spanish to the pitcher, and the pitcher nods. The grandstand celebrates with the team mascot prancing pantomime in a duck suit, a lightning bug called Louie cheerleading for the electric company. Men in caterpillar tractor hats rise from seats to yell at Louie about their electric bills. Ballpark lit in the iron-clouded storm, a ghost dirigible floating overhead and 100 moons misting in the gray air. A train howls in the cornfields. When the water strikes down, white uniforms retreat from the diamond. But in the stands, farm boys with dripping hair holler their hosannas to the rain.
Okay, Martina Spada, you are now off the Budweiser hot seat. And I want to thank you for this evening. And before we leave, I want to play a song by Victor Jara, which is called Te Recuerdo, Amanda. And I want to read to you all the English translation, and then we will hear the song, which is something that escaped from the ashes. I remember you, Amanda, when the streets were wet running to the factory where Manuel was working. With your wide smile and the rain in your hair, nothing else mattered. You were going to meet him. 5 minutes only, all of your life in 5 minutes. The siren is sounding, time to go back to work. And as you walk, you light up everything. Those 5 minutes have made you flower. I remember you, Amanda, when the streets were wet running to the factory where Manuel was working. With your wide smile and the rain in your hair, nothing else mattered. You were going to meet him. And he took to the mountains to fight. He had never heard a fly, but he took to the mountains. And in 5 minutes, it was all wiped out. The siren is sounding. Time to go back to work. Many will not go back. One of them is Manuel. I remember you, Amanda, when the streets were wet running to the factory where Manuel was working. Now I'd like to hear the voice of Victor Jara.
Te recuerdo, Amanda, la calle mojada, corriendo a la fábrica donde trabajaba Manuel. La sonrisa ancha La lluvia en el pelo, no importaba nada, ibas a encontrarte con él, con él, con él, con él, con él. Son 5 minutos, la vida es eterna en 5 minutos. Suena la sirena de vuelta al trabajo y tú caminando lo iluminas todo, los 5 minutos te hacen florecer. Te recuerdo, Amanda, la calle mojada, corriendo a la fábrica donde trabajaba Manuel. La sonrisa ancha, la lluvia en el pelo, no importaba nada. Ibas a encontrarte con él, con él, con él, con él, con él, que partió a la sierra, que nunca hizo daño, que partió a la sierra, y en 5 minutos quedó destrozado. Suena la sirena de vuelta al trabajo, muchos no volvieron, tampoco Manuel. Te recuerdo, Amanda, la calle mojada, corriendo a la fábrica donde trabajaba Manuel.
Thank you all for this evening.
Thank you.
Hasta la victoria siempre.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Heaney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.